With the 100th anniversary of World War I upon us and another professor turned president in office, this seems like a great moment to ask, who was Woodrow Wilson? A. Scott Berg will join us to talk about his new biography.
I don't think there's another president whose life was more dramatic in the White House.
And who was Miss Anne? Carla Kaplan will tell us about the white women of the Black Renaissance.
As soon as white women became seriously involved in Black causes at this time, the press assumed they had some kind of prurient sexual motive.
What kind of recovery is it when huge numbers of Americans remain mired in poverty? Sasha Abramski joins to talk about his new book, The American Way of Poverty, How the Other Half Still Lives.
There'd be no other advanced country in the world with 1 in 6 people hungry. No other advanced country in the world where it's this difficult to get affordable health care.
Julie Bosman will bring us notes from the field, and Greg Coles has bestseller news. This is Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Pamela Paul.
This podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 150,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature, including fiction, nonfiction, and periodicals. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audible.com/bookreview.
A. Scott Berg joins us by phone from Seattle to talk about his new book, Wilson. Hi, Scott.
How are you this morning?
I'm good. Thanks for joining us. You've been working on this book for 10 years.
10 years plus, 13 years.
13 years. Okay. Your previous books, of course, on Lindbergh, on Max Perkins, Samuel Goldwyn. What interested you in doing this biography of Wilson?
Well, I've long had an interest in Wilson. I mean, ever since I was a child, in fact, I began reading about him. But I would say as an adult, two things were occurring to me, and that's what compelled me to write the book. The first was I increasingly saw and continue to believe that Woodrow Wilson may just be the most influential figure of the 20th century. The second is I don't think there's another president whose life was more dramatic in the White House. Just the personal life was one of the great dramas in American history.
And you, of course, knew 13 years ago that another professor would be in office as president at the time that your book came out, and that it would be right on the eve of the 100th anniversary of World War I. But it does seem like there are some interesting parallels.
There are numerous parallels, and each day that I pick up the New York Times, I see more parallels. Going back to this very week when President Obama is dealing with the situation in Syria, first of all, a country that was basically invented during Woodrow Wilson's time after World War I. But I just see so many similarities in the questions President Obama is asking because they were first raised by President Wilson.
Are there any similarities, parallels that you found between the two men?
Well, I think on a personal level, there's a number of similarities. Certainly, they were both considered rather aloof. They both come out of academia. They are both constitutional scholars, both apparently loving husbands and fathers. I don't know about the case of President Obama. I presume it. But in the case of Woodrow Wilson, he was deeply in love with two wives, his first wife dying while they were in office, and a doting father to three daughters.
And one of those daughters, the letters between Wilson and those daughters became available to you when you were doing your research.
That is correct. In fact, it's even more than the letters to them because a number of those had become available. But a few years ago, several trunks of all her letters became available, which were thousands of letters between her and her husband, her and her father, her and her sisters, in which they talk about Woodrow Wilson and all the family detail. So this was the kind of stuff biographers dream of because it really helps us flesh out our subject. And that was always the primary intention I had in writing this book, and that was to humanize Woodrow Wilson, to present a very personal document about somebody who inhabited the White House.
What did you learn from those letters, the daughter's letters, that sort of hadn't been out there or that changed your point of view?
Well, I think I learned that Woodrow Wilson was a much more passionate, more deeply emotional human being than even I knew, and I had been reading a lot about Wilson over the decades, and I think certainly more than most people know. He was a rather private man, but in that privacy, to those in the inner circle, they saw somebody quite different from that very grim-looking Presbyterian minister's son. And don't get me wrong, he had that streak to him, but he had an entire other side. That, again, is what I was really trying to convey in this book, because often that really informs the decisions he makes as a president.
And now, of course, his wife died while he was in office, and then he had a series of strokes. And then his second wife, the impression is that she kind of stepped in.
Well, I think there's no denying that. Woodrow Wilson, in 1919, facing a Senate that was fighting his League of Nations and the treaty that he had brought back from Paris, decided to take his cause to the public, embarked on a 29-city tour of the United States, and midway collapsed and was rushed back to the White House, where a few days later he suffered from a stroke. A stroke which Mrs. Wilson, the second Mrs. Wilson, and a team of doctors kept a secret from the world for virtually a year and a half. And during that time, one can argue, Mrs. Wilson became the first female president of the United States, because basically, while she would be the first to tell you she made no decisions her husband wouldn't have or didn't make, she was the one who was the gatekeeper. She was the one who decided who, and very few were among the who, got to see the President of the United States, and more important, what documents came before the President, what issues came before him.
Was he completely incapacitated during that year?
He was not completely incapacitated. He was physically disabled. In the stroke, he was paralyzed on his left side, but sort of miraculously, he did not lose his powers of speech or his ability to reason. He could think, so he had all that. But, you know, we've learned a lot about strokes in the last century. And, of course, a stroke can really affect an emotional life. The book tries to assess some of the things that were going on, you know, within Wilson's mind and his feelings in this last year and a half, when there were still some decisions to be made, even though to a large extent the government of the United States kind of rolled to a, well, not to a halt, but to a slow crawl.
And one of the other sources of information you got, of course, were the letters of his personal physician and friend, Dr. Cary Grayson.
Dr. Grayson was not only Wilson's personal physician, but really became his closest confidant and friend. And when his last son died a few years ago, they discovered trunkloads full of papers again. And these really chronicled the man who literally had his finger on the pulse of the President of the United States. So all these notes and documents that Dr. Grayson kept, in many cases letters to his wife in which he confides things that nobody else gets to know, really allowed me to monitor the president's health, as Dr. Grayson did, day by day.
There's always this question with biography about whether the biographer, how you feel and toward your subject. Did you go into this sort of an admirer of Wilson? Did your opinion change over the course of your research?
Well, I did go in an admirer, and I emerge as an admirer in that this is a man, whether you like him or not, whether you agree with him or not, did change the world and did deeply influence the world in which we live today. That part is undeniable. Along the way, he became increasingly human, and I often became extremely irritated, if not angry, at him as a man, not just as a subject. And there are, of course, some severe political strikes against him that are hard to read about 100 years later, specifically his views on race and in reinvoking the Alien and Sedition Act, as he did, which really suppressed free speech in this country to an extent that really never had been. I found him rather vengeful. He could be extremely spiteful. So these are all things that are troubling for an admirer, but I still try to present as an objective a case as I can about Woodrow Wilson, as is possible. Again, this is a man who changed the world. He was mighty, whether you like him or not.
Well, and it's always a big publishing event when a new biography by A. Scott Berg comes out. So, Scott, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
And the book again is Wilson by A. Scott Berg.
This podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 150,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature and featuring audio versions of many New York Times bestsellers. Audible is offering listeners of this podcast a free audiobook when you try Audible free for 30 days. One audiobook to consider is The Smartest Kids in the World and How They Got That Way by Amanda Ripley. That's The Smartest Kids in the World, and it's available on Audible. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audible.com/bookreview. That's audible.com/bookreview.
Julie Bosman is here to talk about what's new in the field. Julie, what's going on?
So we have a lot of news this week, but the main thing that people are talking about this week is a big change to the Man Booker Prize. This is, of course, the most prestigious literary prize in Britain, and for years it's been something that always belonged to the UK. It was open to writers from Ireland and from the Commonwealth, but not, of course, the Americans. So the Booker Prize, after a few leaks earlier this week, have confirmed that there is going to be a global expansion of Booker eligibility, and it will be open to any authors writing in English.
And this comes out the same week that the National Book Awards has started giving out their long lists for the first time.
Yes, so prize season is in full swing.
Taking a bit of the spotlight away, but I guess expanding the field for American authors.
In the announcement this week, the Booker Prize Committee said that the prize will now recognize, celebrate, and embrace authors writing in English, whether from Chicago or Shanghai. So I think what they're trying to do here is expand the sweep of the prize to reinforce the Booker's standing as what they say is the most important literary award in the English-speaking world. I think the administrators of the Nobel and the Pulitzer and the National Book Award might disagree with that, but the chairman of the trustees for the Booker, Jonathan Taylor, the chairman of the trustees for the Booker, said that this will embrace the freedom of English in all its vigor, its vitality, its versatility, and its glory wherever it may be. And they really want to do away with what they call the constraints of geography and national boundaries.
What's the timeline on all of this?
So the Booker for this year is going to be announced on October 15th, but we already know the shortlist of writers. So it will not apply to this year. It will start in 2014. So I think during the prize ceremony this year, which is always in the evening in London, there'll probably be a lot of complaining among the Brits about the changes to the prize next year.
Thanks, Julie.
Thanks.
Carla Kaplan is the author of a new book, Miss Anne in Harlem, The White Women of the Black Renaissance. Carla joins us now to talk about it. Hi, Carla.
Hi, Pamela. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming. So who is Miss Anne?
It's a term that has always had immediate recognizability in Black communities. In fact, if you say the phrase Miss Anne in a room full of Black folks, everybody sort of giggles and snickers. But it used to be, at least prior to September 10th, that if you said the phrase Miss Anne in a room full of white people, they just looked at you completely bewildered. What the phrase has always meant, it's been a derisive term for any white woman. So it's a way of putting all white women into one category, denying them their names, and just sort of dismissing them as a group as Miss Anne. And you'd hear people say things like, oh, don't listen to her. She works for Miss Anne.
Mm-hmm. Now, you say prior to September 10th, because that's the date when a story about your book appeared in the Times.
Exactly. And I think
for those who missed it.
I mean, I'm hoping as a consequence of my book, the phrase will be more recognizable across both sides of the color line. But it does point to the fact that we do still have an operating color line. It was a way for black folks to do in a very small and a very subtle way what had been done to them for decades and indeed centuries, which is to say to take a whole group of people and typecast them and dismiss them in a category, which is, of course, what had been happening to black folks for so long. So when white women went to Harlem in the 1920s, and this is a book about white women who were breaking race taboos to cross into the Harlem Renaissance, they were up against not just negative views from white society, which was telling them you cannot do that. But they knew they were up against this Miss Anne idea, this idea that white women should be dismissed by the black community as Miss Anne.
So, do we know the origins of that phrase, Miss Anne?
The phrase goes back quite a bit before the Harlem Renaissance. And I've heard different things about its origins, none of which I entirely believe. I don't think it refers to a particular Anne in the same way that the phrase Mr. Charlie doesn't seem to refer to any particular Mr. Charlie, or sometimes you hear the phrase Mr. Eddie. They all three work in the same way. But it was a phrase that began to have a lot of currency during the Harlem Renaissance. I think it can be found earlier. It can also be found later. There's a wonderful, wonderful Little Richard song called Miss Anne. Miss Anne, Miss Anne, you're doing something no one can. So it still is a phrase that kind of percolates up from time to time, but it was really, it had a lot of currency and mm-hmm. a lot of saliency during the Harlem Renaissance.
Now, it was okay at the time for white men to go uptown.
It was not only okay for white men to go uptown into Harlem for some hot jazz and some good food and some dancing, but it was encouraged. There was this notion that was prevalent during the time that white culture was depleted, was bankrupt, lacked a kind of spiritual core. It was connected with what's called the primitivist movement. And the idea was very much that other cultures, capital O, but so-called primitive cultures, could be an antidote to what was wrong, what was lacking in white culture. And white men were encouraged almost medicinally to go up to Harlem and have their spirits restored.
When we talk about this period of the Harlem Renaissance, what years are we talking about?
We're really talking about the early 1920s. Mm-hmm. And in the case of the white women who started really going seriously into Harlem, not just up to the Harlem cabarets, we're talking about the mid-1920s, right through the Depression years and into the early 30s.
And were they in general going uptown to, you know, to study it, to enjoy it, to participate in it, to lose themselves in it? What was the motive? I'm sure it was different from person to person, but
there were lots and lots of white women who went uptown just to see the cabarets and to observe, and then, you know, scurried into taxi cabs to get back downtown and back home. And this is not really a book about that phenomenon. It's not really a book about that slumming notion, although that idea backgrounds what the women I write about were doing. I write about women who had a much more serious commitment to black culture and early black civil rights. What they were trying to do, in essence, was volunteer for blackness. The women I write about wanted to be, in a much more serious way, contributors to the cultural movement that was the Harlem Renaissance and participants in it. And they did that in a very brave and bold way, but also at great cost, because what they were doing, to go back to your earlier question, was very much frowned upon. It was something white men were allowed to do. White women were not supposed to do this in any serious way. It was seen as changing their very nature, changing their very core. And the women I write about, that's what they were signing up for. They wanted to change their very core.
Well, during this same period in America, and particularly in the South, there was this whole notion of black men as being this horrible threat to the sanctity of white women.
That idea, the myth, as it's often called, of the black rapist, goes back centuries. It had been a crucial tool during slavery to keep the black community in check. Because as long as that myth was propagated, it was a way for white society to really rigorously police black behavior, particularly black male behavior. One of the historical issues that puts weight on the women I write about, that is baggage they take with them, is the role that white women historically, as a group, played in that myth and in that history. And there are centuries of white women really failing, for the most part, to stand up and say, don't you dare do this in my name. I challenge this myth. There is no truth to this. And so part of the sort of negative connotation of Miss Anne is her danger, the sense that white women pose a genuine threat to the lives of black people, specifically black men, because the other side of the myth of the black rapist is the endangered, vulnerable white woman whom he is supposed to be attacking. And as long as white women played into that myth, they were complicit in that history.
Did these women see themselves as these kind of feminists? Was it about women's rights as much as it was about race?
Some of these women definitely came to Harlem and came to their decision to cross into Harlem out of a sense that gender was constraining them. So if we look, for example, at the case of Mary White Ovington, white founder of the NAACP, a woman born into the post-Victorian upper-middle-class world of whist parties and a very little bit of social charity on the side, she didn't want that life. So when she became a civil rights activist and moved into black communities, it bought her a kind of freedom. Because who in Harlem was going to tell this older white activist from Brooklyn Heights what to do? Nobody. Nobody was going to tell her what to do. White society was pretty much done with her. They washed their hands of her. And, of course, blacks in Harlem weren't going to tell her what to do. And it was a kind of freedom for women like Mary White Ovington, for women like Annie Nathan-Meyer, who wrote a searing, searing indictment, not just of lynching, but of white women's complicity with the myths that had undergirded lynching for centuries.
She was the founder of Barnard.
She was the founder of Barnard, and she wrote this play called Black Souls that's the most astonishing critique and indictment of white women I think I've ever seen. By taking up black causes, it allowed her also to act as a feminist, to be a strong woman, to be in the public sphere, to be taken seriously politically. So gender and race are coming together at this moment, but they're also coming together in the other sense, which is that everything white women did in a serious way in Harlem was sexualized by the mainstream press. So that as soon as white women became seriously involved in black causes at this time, the press assumed they had some kind of purient sexual motive. In fact, the white press even accused Mary White Ovington of being involved, again, you know, founder of the NAACP, right? But accused her of being involved in black causes to procure black lovers for young white women. So gender and race come together in some really explosive and complicated ways at this time.
Up in Harlem today, there are not as many signs of the Harlem Renaissance as one might expect. Are there any signs of Miss Anne still in Harlem? Is this a visible legacy in any way?
I do not think that to the casual tourist who comes to Harlem, she is in any way visible. In fact, I would say she's probably almost completely invisible. Recently, I went on some Harlem walking tours, mostly because I wanted to see what casual tourists, most of whom are coming from other countries, what ideas of Harlem they bring and what they've known, what has carried over almost 100 years later and across the ocean. And they know two things. You know, they know jazz and they know danger, right? So they have a sense that Harlem is a dangerous place, which, of course, is a post-Harlem Renaissance idea. I don't think they even know enough about the cultural explosion that was the real heart of the Harlem Renaissance for the notion that white women were part of it to really be entering that story.
This book, I think, clearly brings out a side of the Harlem Renaissance that many people who know a lot about that period still don't know about. It's a fascinating history. The book, again, is Miss Anne in Harlem, The White Women of the Black Renaissance. And the author is Carla Kaplan. Carla, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Sasha Abramski joins us from Sacramento to talk about his new book, The American Way of Poverty, How the Other Half Still Lives. Hi, Sasha.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for joining us. I was just reading, I guess, the not part of a good morning on the way to work today, a story in the Times about homeless people in New York City who work sometimes two jobs and still are unable to afford housing in the city, which even in the South Bronx or East New York is $1,000 a month for an apartment, and that there are still, I think, 55,000 counted homeless people in the city. I'm sure this is not news to you, having looked at this issue, but is this problem of working poor and yet completely unable to get by new, or is this something that's been around for a long time in the States?
I think what we saw, and there's always been poverty in America. There have always been enclaves of poverty, and there have always been some people who work and still can't make ends meet. That was the motivation for Jacob Riis's great expose about 100 years ago of the living conditions that the working poor on the Lower East Side were going through.
How the Other Half Lives.
Yeah, and you know, so How the Other Half Lived 100 years ago showed that. John Steinbeck showed it in The Grapes of Wrath. There have always been some people who have jobs, but those jobs pay a pittance and they can't afford the basics of life. I think what we're seeing now, though, is something very, very different. It's the scale of it. The fact that so many people who work for large corporations still can't make ends meet, and they're juggling bills. Now, some of those people will end up homeless, and I interviewed a lot of people in that situation. Others will end up hungry. So I interviewed an old woman who worked for Walmart. She was in her late 60s. She lived outside Dallas, Texas, and she had all kinds of health ailments. And one of the things she had was diabetes, and so she was supposed to eat quite carefully. But she said, look, I just can't afford it. So I end up eating 88 cents TV dinners that I buy at Walmart, or I miss meals. And she showed me her pay stubs, and then she ran down all her expenses. And she was absolutely right. There was no way that she could juggle all of her bills on what she was earning. I spoke to a teacher, a guy called Jim Miller, and he lived in San Diego, and he was part of this walk called March for California's Future that took place a couple years ago. And it was a group of educators who marched up California's Central Valley to the state capital of Sacramento so they could put a spotlight on the education crisis, the funding crisis in California, but more generally on the economic crisis. And I joined them for a couple days on this walk so I could report with them. And they were staying in campsites in the evenings. And so we stayed in campsites in the Central Valley. And in the mornings, you'd see these people in the campsite bathrooms clearly getting ready for work. They weren't on holiday. They were putting on their professional clothes. They were getting ready for work. And I asked him about this. And he said, yeah, we've seen this all up the Central Valley, that people who've gone into foreclosure on their homes are now living in RVs in campsites. they're going to work in the morning from campsites. And I think that is different. And I think those kind of stories, and I encountered hundreds of people around the country in situations like this, those kind of stories really are one of the great unspoken, undeveloped stories of our era.
There was this document that surfaced online and got a lot of attention that I think was an internal document at McDonald's that they had brought in some consultants. Do you know what I'm talking about?
I know exactly what you're talking about. It was McDonald's, under pressure from labor activists, who'd put out this monthly budget where they could estimate how someone on a McDonald's wage could survive. And it got all kinds of controversy because, among other things, one of the things it just didn't budget for was heating. So if you're a McDonald's worker and you live in the Northeast and it's really cold in winter, McDonald's thinks you can do it. But the way they think you can do it is you keep your house really, really cold. Now, as it happens, my last book was a book called Breadline USA, and it was about hunger in America. This came out about 4 years ago. And I actually did an experiment. I put myself onto the equivalent income that a McDonald's worker working 40 hours a week would be on. And I went through a series of experiments as to what it does to your food budget if one or two things go wrong. So if you go into work and your employer says, well, work slow this week, we're taking 5 hours off your week, so you're only working 35 hours. Or you've been borrowing on your credit card, but you max out, so you have to go onto a cash-only budget. Or just something really minor, gas prices go up 30 or 40 cents a gallon, but you live in a trailer park outside town, and you're driving into work, and that means $10 a week difference in gas, and that comes out of your food budget. And I did this experiment, and trust me, after several weeks on that, I wasn't eating very well.
You were hungry.
I wasn't eating nutritionally. And my experiment was designed to see how long can you go, how many things go wrong before you have no choice but to end up on a food bank line. And it didn't take very long. It involved about four or five permutations, and I got to a point where I would either literally go hungry or I would go and get charity food. And so I think when you see these stories and you hear these stories and you hear about old ladies working and having to live off TV dinners, and you hear about people working two jobs and, as you said, ending up sleeping on subways at night, it speaks to a huge problem in this country. And what I talk about in my book, In the American Way of Poverty, this isn't a problem about scarcity. This is a problem about inequality.
Right.
This is a problem that's emerging as our economy becomes more and more skewed towards those right at the top of the economic ladder.
Data came out, I think, this week as well that showed that the bottom 80% of Americans, the standard of living had not improved since the 80s. In some cases, you know, stagnated or went down. And it was really only for the most educated and most affluent that things had ticked up at all.
Yeah, there's been a flurry of data on this that's come out in the last couple of weeks. And one of the bits of data was that we're now a more unequal society income-wise than any time in the last 100 years. You have to go back to just after the World War I period to get to inequality levels that look like what we have today, which means that the society we live in 2013 increasingly would be one familiar to our great-great-grandparents, but not to the generations in between. So that's one bit of data that came out. And the other bit, as you said, is that for the vast majority of Americans, even though the economy is growing, even though as a whole the economy is recovering from the terrible series of crises in 2007, 2008, 2009, most Americans aren't benefiting. And it's actually worse than that, because if you really go down into the data, what you see is the lower down the economic ladder you are, the more you're not benefiting.
Right.
The more you're struggling just to stay in place, and there's a pretty good likelihood you're actually getting swept backward, that your income is going down in real terms, that your benefits are going down, that your access to pensions, your access to health care on the job is going down.
So there's not only this huge gap between the affluent and the poor, but also a gap between the state of the economy and the lives of most American citizens.
Yeah, I mean, there's this tremendous disjunct that if you just look at the big economic data, so you look at what the stock market's doing, you look at GDP, GMP, on those levels, the economy is actually doing okay. But then when you actually look at the lives lived, not by the poor exclusively, though particularly by the poor, but also by middle-class Americans, daily insecurity is becoming more and more of a reality for the majority of Americans. That sense of uncertainty, that sense, will I have a job tomorrow? If I do, will it cover my bills? If it doesn't cover my bills, well, what am I going to have to juggle? And I spoke to families who said, well, you know, I send my kids to school hungry because it's the only way I can stay with a roof over our heads. Or I buy prescription drugs because otherwise I'll get very, very sick. But in buying those drugs, it means that I risk my gas or my telephone being cut off. And I spoke to families in all over the country. It wasn't just in traditionally poor enclaves. I spoke to people in suburban Las Vegas who had lost everything in the housing crisis. I spoke to people in East Los Angeles, honors students. They were kids of immigrants, and they were being college tracked. They were kids who had been identified as being very smart and should be going to college. and their parents had lost their jobs, and they told me, look, we're facing this huge quandary because our teachers are telling us we should go to university, but our parents are telling us we need income for the family. And so some of those kids were dropping out of school and trying to get $7 and $8 an hour jobs. And I thought, you know, what a catastrophe that as a society we are letting this happen. And the way I phrase it in the book is it strikes me that at a certain point this no longer is a tragedy. It's actually a scandal. It's a scandal because our political process is proving itself absolutely unable to deal with what I think is one of the great moral challenges of our era, this idea that tens of millions of Americans are now falling outside of the American dream or falling outside of the American story, that narrative of opportunity. And it's something we have to deal with. You know, I write very specifically about ways of dealing with it, ways of changing the political conversation, ways of putting in place policy reforms that are very doable, that have been done on a local level. But so far, the will hasn't been done to do them federally, to do them across the 50 states. And I think that this is a conversation that increasingly is going to define what kind of a country we become over the coming decades. And I look at other countries, and I've traveled all over the world, and I see that other countries do things differently. In some areas, some arena, they do things worse than America. But in other areas, they do things better. For example, there'd be no other advanced country in the world with 1 in 6 people hungry. No other advanced country in the world where it's this difficult to get affordable health care. And I think that understanding that some of the ways we shape our society is actually very dysfunctional and actually hurts a lot of people, I think that allows for a richer analysis of what's going on in the country. And so for me, it's always been very good to have this sort of inside-out perspective.
All right. Well, that perspective, I think, comes through in your new book. It is called The American Way of Poverty, How the Other Half Lives. And the author is Sasha Abramski. Sasha, thank you so much.
You're very welcome. Thank you for having me on.
Greg Coles is here with Bestseller News. Hi, Greg.
Hi, Pamela.
So we have lots of good new books on the list this week.
All kinds of books, good, not good, in between. I'll start on the combined side, and then I'll buzz over to the hardcover list also, where there are some titles that don't appear on the combined list.
I thought you were going to say, I'll start with the good and then with the bad. Or
no, I'll let readers draw their own conclusions
that.
The combined list, combined fiction, Sue Grafton has the latest of her Kinsey Millhone alphabet series. W is for Wasted. She's up to W now. There's just X, Y, Z left. She's been asked a lot recently what X will be. She says it has to be xenophobe or xenophobia because xylophone is not a crime.
So apparently she got the idea for the alphabet concept from the Ghastly Crumb Tinies.
Edward Gorey.
Yes.
I did not know that.
I know. It delights me.
I also didn't know, actually, her father, C.W. Grafton, was a detective writer in his own right. Also new on the list this week, on the combined list, new at number 5, J.A. Jantz, who writes several different detective series, has a new one in her Beaumont series called Second Watch. That's new at number 5. At number 8, a continuation of a longtime detective series by an author who has now died, Robert B. Parker. His Jesse Stone series has been picked up and continued by a guy named Michael Brandman. And Robert B. Parker's Damned If You Do by Michael Brandman is new on the list at number 8. And then finally on the combined fiction list, there's a book called The Scoop, new at number 13. That's by Fern Michaels, who had a lot of success earlier with her Sisterhood series. She's now starting a new series called The Godmother series, which is kind of a hoot. It's about a rich old widow married 8 times, and she's now a multimillionaire, and she's using her money to try to buy a Hollywood tabloid and help out her reporter daughter.
So series dominating the new or not so new fiction list.
On the combined fiction list,
yes.
That's right. And there are two titles I wanted to mention on the hardcover fiction list that are new there as well. One of them is Alice McDermott's new novel, Someone, which has just been announced as a contender for the National Book Awards in fiction. And that book is new at number 9 on the hardcover fiction list. Then new at number 11 is a book called Songs of Willow Frost by Jamie Ford. Then back over to the combined list for a minute. I'll run down the nonfiction there. There's a bunch of new titles, starting at number 2, Still Foolin' 'Em by Billy Crystal. This is his look at aging. It's partly a memoir looking back at his career and partly a series of rants about getting older, rants and jokes about getting older. Then new at number 3, a book called Empty Mansions by Bill Deadman and Paul Clark Newell Jr. This is a biography of a reclusive heiress in New York. She owned plenty of estates, but she chose to spend the last decades of her life living in hospital rooms, and she left all of the estates empty, hence the title. Then at number 5, a book called A House in the Sky. That's by Amanda Lindhout and Sarah Corbett. Lindhout was a young would-be freelance journalist who really got into the field out of a love of travel and seeing travel as kind of a life-changing pursuit.
Right. She grew up very poor in Canada.
And that's right. She's Canadian. And she traveled to various war zones, intending to kind of throw herself both into the culture and into the craft of journalism to write stories and sell them. And while she was in Somalia in 2008, she was kidnapped and held with her former boyfriend who had come along with her. And they were together held hostage for over a year there before she was released. So this book tells about that experience. At number 8, Sherry Fink, another writer who's published in The Times, has a book called 5 Days at Memorial, which looks at the days after the Hurricane Katrina disaster and specifically a surgeon in New Orleans who is suspected of euthanizing a series of patients there.
And this grew out of a Pulitzer Prize-winning story that she did for the magazine.
That's right, with ProPublica, the nonprofit journalism foundation. That's right. Then new at number 12, the biographer A. Scott Berg, who has previously written books about Max Perkins and Charles Lindbergh, has a new biography he's been working on for a long time called Wilson, which is a biography of Woodrow Wilson, the 28th president. Leonardo DiCaprio has actually just bought the rights to that and hopes to star in that as Woodrow Wilson himself. And then finally on the combined nonfiction list at number 15, a woman named Rebecca Musser has written a book with Bridget Cook called The Witness Wore Red. Musser helped expose crimes within a polygamous sect that she used to belong to, and she fled there and now has written the book about that. And then finally, over on the hardcover nonfiction list, the only other book on there that's not also on the combined list is The Great Nothing to Lose by Ken Sharp with Paul Stanley and Gene Simmons. It's an oral history of the band Kiss.
From Woodrow Wilson to Kiss.
I told you there was a range.
All right. Well, thanks, Greg.
Thanks, Pamela.
Remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. Our producer is Jocelyn Gonzalez, and you can always write to us at books@nytimes.com. Thanks for listening. For the New York Times, I'm Pamela Paul.